And I'll never forget, he dropped me, my mum and dad, a couple of days before I was due to start at Leicester. And Jock was the nicest gentleman you could ever meet. You know, Mr. and Mrs. Warburton, anything you need, you come to Jock. Mark, anything you need, son, you call me Jock. I'm there for you. Nicest man on the planet, Ian. And then the first day at Filbert Street, I think the apprentices who were then, the young scholars as they are now, we had to meet, I think, at a certain time, slightly earlier than normal, to get a kit and whatever else. And I saw the manager in the car park. So bearing in mind, he had just told me to call him Jock and anything I need, come straight to him. I just said, good morning, Jock. And I got the biggest whack around the back of the head, Ian, you've ever seen in your life.
And welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I'm your host, Ian Stephen. And for today's episode, we meet a man who's well known to Boreham, but he's guaranteed to be anything but tedious today. He helped with formation of the Next Gen series, installed Rangers back into the top flight, but cut his teeth as a trader in London. So the big question we need to ask is, Mark Warburton, did you have a yellow Reliant Robin?
Ian, absolutely not. No, I think I must be honest, I had a Ford Capri, or Capri, as he used to say on the show, I believe. So I'm guilty of that one, Ian. But no, never a yellow Reliant Robin, that's for sure.
Well, we're lucky to catch it because you're jetting off to the United States. Is this football related or do you really love Disney?
No, actually, I've got it's a tough market over here. All joking apart, it's a tough market. They're going for younger. So you have to find opportunity, Ian. And I have an opportunity today, so I want to look at and discuss further. But you've got to be practical, and I'm one that likes to work here, if I'm honest with you. I'm not one that can sit at home and do nothing or sit idly. So, it's a case of having a look, seeing what's out there, Ian, and going and hopefully making the right call.
Well, when we go through like your kind of life and times and your work, then it becomes incredibly obvious that you should be a man that should be in football. There's no doubt about that. Let's start at the beginning. Where were you born and brought up, and who was your boyhood club?
I was a London boy. I was born near Tottenham. So Tottenham is my boyhood club. I'm not fanatical, passionate about it as a fan. I am about the game, but not as a fan. My son is far more passionate. But I'll always look for a Tottenham result, Ian. So I was born to a dad who was a bled black and white Geordie. Born in Gateshead, walked over the Tyne Bridge every day at work. So he was a diehard Geordie. And my mum likewise loved the game. And they would, when they moved to London from Newcastle, they would go and watch games. Whoever was playing in London, they'd go and watch games. So I think my love for the game certainly came from them, Ian. But that was it. I was a London boy, born and bred in London. And I've always kept a house here my entire life.
You were a talented footballer as a youngster. And you got into youth football. You got a chance for a professional club. Little did you know that you would have a kind of dalliance with a Rangers legend, and then you would kind of follow on later on. What was your memories of your very early Rangers legend meeting?
I'm always very, very careful because Mr. Wallace, Jock, is a Rangers legend indeed. So I've said some comments, and I actually met his wife and some members of the family. Very, very fortunate to meet them and have a conversation with them. But I was a young kid. Love sports, Ian. I'm sure we all do. We love sports. I was lucky to be good at sports. I found sports very easy. Football being the one that I really loved. I had a lot of running, a lot of other sports, but football was the main love. And I'll never forget, Jock met my mum and dad a couple of days before I was due to start at Leicester. And Jock was the nicest gentleman you could ever meet. You know, Mr. and Mrs. Warburton, anything you need, you come to Jock. Mark, anything you need, son, you call me Jock. I'm there for you. Nicest man on the planet, Ian. And then the first day at Filbert Street, I think the apprentices who were then, the young scholars as they are now, we had to meet, I think, at a certain time, slightly earlier than normal, to get a kit and whatever else. And I saw the manager in the car park. So bearing in mind, he had just told me to call him Jock and anything I need, come straight to him. I just said, good morning, Jock. And I got the biggest whack around the back of the head, Ian, you've ever seen in your life. It was one of those moments when you learn very quickly that there was two sides. So I got smashed around the back of the head. I was called a soft southern, whatever you can want to call me. And that's really how the relationship went from there. And it was a case of there was a north-south divide. Jock was obviously a larger than life character. Ian McFarlane, another big man I got on very well with. Eddie May, and it was a steep learning curve, Ian, but it's one that was, all joking apart, was completely out of my, I was saying comfort zone, that's not right. I'd never come across anything like it in my life before in terms of Jock and how he worked. And he worked in terms of ex-Marine, battering you verbally day in, day out. The last man standing was a man he'd pick. And that was just alien. And you leave yourselves exposed to being saying, well, you're soft and you couldn't deal with it. It was just a complete culture shift in. You know, you got this man, this legend. I remember when a game was called off in Scotland, you know, if Ibrox was called off for bad weather, whatever, we'd had another 10,000 on the gate at Filbert Street because they'd come down to support Jock Wallace. He changed the kit to the Rangers kit. You know, that's how passionate it was. Who for one second would think that 30, 40 years later, I'd be sitting in his office as manager of Rangers. But that was a really steep learning curve for me. And I'll be honest with you, for a boy who loves sport, loves football, he turned me not off the game, but turned me, just destroyed confidence. And I know I spoke to one or two other kids who were there at the same time, who in later life told me exactly the same, that his way was so alien, Ian. It was a really steep learning curve, and not one that I embraced, not one. And even then, as a young 16, 17, 18-year-old professional, I remember saying to myself, I would never work in that manner. Never would. And I kept to that right through my work in the city and coaching and managing, because I've always been a believer in treat people with respect and how you're spoken to, et cetera. And Jock was just a different breed. He was just a different breed completely. But take nothing away from the success he achieved with Rangers, and his legendary status always be intact. But just fair to say, he didn't work well with me.
Well, you moved on to Enfield once you left, and Enfield won the FA Trophy when you were kind of there at the club. Were you actually in the side that won at Wembley?
Yeah, I squad for that. I was in the city then, and I was in that period, Ian, where the city started off. I was getting more money from playing for Enfield than I was working the bank in the city. And then slowly those two worlds got level, and then the city started to take over, and the hours were insane. You know, it's well documented, but I was in the office by 5:45 every morning. I was up at 4:30. You didn't get home until 7:30 at the earliest. And it demanded. So I got to the stage where I used to train on a Tuesday and Thursday night as semi-pros, and I was going straight from the city, straight to training, getting home at 10:30, not having anything to eat, getting up again at 4:30, and away we go. So he just got that point. So yeah, we had a really good squad though. I loved being there. I still chat the manager, Eddie McCluskey, actually, I spoke to him last week. But we won the trophy, we won what is now the conference, and it was a really great time to be at the club. But as I say, it was a good time because my city career was going in the right direction as well. So it was a really enjoyable time in.
Here's a kind of very good question, maybe a parallel, but you've won football games as a manager at the highest level, and you've also won trades, in effect, when you're trading in the currency markets. Is it the same sort of drug, the same sort of rush you get from winning?
Yeah, it's. I'm always asked the question, what comes with more pressure? And you've got to answer football because of the fact that there's so many emotions and people's emotions involved in football. So, you know, when Rangers win or lose a game, it's not just myself or the staff or the players, it's all of the hundreds of thousands of fans that it affects. So that's the only difference, really. But in terms of people can't comprehend, Ian, quite how much money used to go or goes through the city. It's not, you know, when I said millions, like millions, it's hundreds of billions of dollars every day going through it, just in the currency markets. And we would turn over what now would appear to be staggeringly large amounts. And the pressure was always on. You know, you would trade in lumps of $3, $5, $10, $20, $50, $100 million. And you're doing it all day, you know, and you would turn over $2, $2.5 billion, and your desk would do, 10 guys would do the same. So you've got a desk of 10 guys, one small part of a dealing room, turn over $25 billion on a daily basis. So it gave you some idea, but with that came the pressure, and you could lose some serious amounts of money and of course make it. And that was a black and white nature of the business here that I really enjoyed. I liked that, you know, if you did well, you got rewarded. If you didn't, you know, you lost your job. That's football, right? If you play well, you get a new contract. If you don't, you lose your place in the team. You eventually leave the club and try and find another employer. And that was a very, very similar type of environment. So I like that one where if you work hard, if you do well, you get rewarded. I really like that basis. And, you know, I was lucky to work at some really big banks, top tier level banks, and Bank of America, AIG, RBS, Nomura, these type of banks, and really enjoy what was over 20 years doing that particular job.
Football can be very kind, but it can be cruel as well. And am I right in saying that you had to kind of stop playing relatively early due to injury?
Yeah, I did. I did my cruciate early. And then in those days, Ian, obviously, the treatment was nowhere near as good as it is now. The knowledge of the injury was less. So the rehabilitation process was very different. And then I came back, I think within 4 or 5 games, a horrendous tackle was even worse than the first one. Took out ACL, medial, everything went in the knee. So that was really it in terms of that respect. But again, I remember the demands in the city, and such was the enjoyment of the work. You might think I'm absolutely crazy here, but I remember I had the operation done privately at Princess Grace in London, and you're meant to be in for X number of days. And I think I was in for on the third day, they put you in a Don Joy brace, and a car from the bank picked me up outside Princess Grace and drove me straight to the bank. And I basically hobbled in on my Don Joy brace and my crutches. And every morning a car picked for the next 4 or 5 weeks, a car picked me up at 5 o'clock in the morning or 4:30 in the morning and dropped me back home at 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, because it was just work, right? You just did it. And now you hear people say, I took 6 weeks off for this. And not in those days, and they weren't their pound of flesh, literally. So injury curtailed it, but I was lucky that it was so competitive in that other world. People who haven't seen it would never understand that, between working the banks competitive. It was like going into a match every single day. I remember being on a golf trip with a few of the guys, and we were down in Tewkesbury, and we were playing this course, and we were meant to play Thursday afternoon, 2 rounds on Friday, play on Saturday and come home Saturday night. That was a plan. And then there were big numbers coming out of America, the economic numbers, which come out 8:30 New York time, 1:30 London time on the Friday. And we're sitting in the bar on the Thursday night, we've had a game of golf, and we're all looking at each other going, it's going to be busy tomorrow. It's going to be really busy. And everyone had the same thought, but no one was at the balls to say it. And we just turned around and went, we should really be at work tomorrow. So we've given up. The weather forecast was magnificent. Got these great golf courses. And we literally drove home late on the Thursday night. And we went into work on the Friday, and the boss has gone, what are you doing here? It was such a drug, you didn't want to miss out. It's like a good game, a good training session. And people, as I say, time after time, and they look at you like you must be off your rocker. But such was the nature of the work then. Such was the teamwork and the camaraderie and the togetherness and the enjoyment, really, that you give up your golf, you come back and you work. And people would say it's bizarre to say that, but then it made perfect sense.
You took a really bold step, because you're talking about trading like you really, really enjoyed it, and it gave you a stable financial future. But at some point you had to have the conversation with your family going, listen, I really enjoy coaching and I want to pursue this. You must have the gift of the gab to talk your wife around to that, surely.
Yeah, well, I wish I did have the gift. Clearly I didn't have the gift of the gab in this situation here. It really started, I'll try and keep it in a nutshell. My son was then, I think, Jack was born in 93. So by the time he got to 8, a few clubs were asking to go to an academy. All the kids go in academies and play football. He loved football to death and he played it. And he was a talented boy, wanted to be a professional and a decent career. So he did okay. But at the time, he was doing that and I was watching it. And if I jump back, when I was in the city, I lived in Charlotte, North Carolina. I lived in Chicago. I lived in Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York. Wherever I went and lived, if you had a British accent, Ian, they just presumed you played football and coached football. That was the old mentality, especially in the States. So I always just coached. I coached under-9 girls teams, under-8 boys, high school teams, college teams, bank teams. You name it, I just coached them because I love football. And I didn't even think about the qualifications. In my ignorance, I didn't even know a qualification existed. So I get back and I take my son to Watford, where he went in the end. And the guy said, I used to play. I said, yeah, I used to play a bit and play semi-pro. And he goes, oh, I said, I enjoy coaching. He said, what level are you? I said, what's the level? Didn't even know. So in 2001, I think I did my level 1 and quickly got my level 2. The tutor was a guy that was fantastic for me, a guy called Ted Dale. who was Chelsea Canada director before and is still working for the FA now. And he then said to me, get on the level three quickly. So I don't say it arrogantly, but I enjoyed it. I was decent at it. And he accelerated me to go through level three. And then very quickly, I find myself on an A license, which is the second highest qualification. And I was at Royal Bank of Scotland, the senior trader, chief trader. And I remember being on that call scene with people like Ray Wilkins, Dean Saunders, Adrian Heath, Clayton Blackmore, Chris Coleman, Barry Horn. So on a Saturday with my son, I'd sit and watch Match of the Day and watch all of these players play. And then here I am on a course for 2 weeks with this level of player. I'm working the bank. What I learned there, Ian, I'm sure I digress a little bit and jump about, but what I learned there was the bank and that market, that trading market I described to you, was a hook. So Ray Wilkins, I remember, pulled me. We had a glass of wine and we were sitting down and talking, and he was fascinated by, buy $10 million here, you sell 10 minutes, where's the profit? I was going through it, right, so you do this. We were going through all that. He was fascinated. But that I realized quickly then that, because footballers are well paid, they have nice cars, good holidays, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So they're not very easily, I'm saying, impressed. But you don't, it's very hard to catch their attention. And that was a hook for me. So that allowed me. So now, if you can imagine, I've got my son playing in the academy. I'm now an A-licensed coach. It's 2003, 2004. And I now want to go coaching. I now want to do it. And that's when I had 6 months of racking my brains going, how am I going to explain to this where I'm going to take a 96, 97% pay cut here? I'm going in on bare basic money at Watford Academy, who had no money at the time in. They were skint. And I remember my wife saying to me at the time that your gross salary doesn't even pay our daughter's school fees. And I said, well, I've been lucky. I put some money aside. And I also knew, you know, I'd sound a little bit prophetic here, but I wasn't. I'd put some money aside. So I knew my level of knowledge wasn't deep enough. I knew that I'd great doing your lay license. That's great. But you know yourself, in whatever line of work, you need on the ground knowledge, you need experience, you need to watch practitioners work. And so I decided to take a year out of my own money, cost me a lot, a fair bit, at the same time making sure the family never had their quality of life dip. And I just went around a number of clubs in Europe, and the skills I got from the city in had allowed me to do so. What do I mean by that? I had cold, when I came back from Charlotte, for example, I was a young trader. I'd cold called and pestered the Tokyo banks to do business with me. Literally, if you imagine it, every morning Industrial Bank of Japan, Bank of Tokyo, Bank of Yoga, I'm just throwing them all up saying, deal with me, deal with me, deal with me. And I was being, just go away, like swatted like a fly. And finally, one guy dealt with me, and that was my route in. That was my catalyst in the city. And in the football world, I think it was 43 clubs I called and got basically just told to go somewhere. And it was the 44th one, a guy called Diogo Matos, who was Academy Director of Sport Lisbon, ex-Portuguese international, now working for FIFA, still a dear friend, spoke to her this week. And he said to me, if you can play, get on a plane, come over. I'm playing golf in the morning. Do you play golf? When you play golf? He said, come over, we'll have 5 hours. I'll give you 5 hours of my time. Story short, jumped on the EasyJet flight, got into Lisbon, had a great round of golf with him, and we got in like a house on fire, stayed a couple of days, and he said, we'll go back, drop your clothes, get some more clothes, come over, spend a couple of weeks with us, and I'll show you through everything. And suddenly, Ian, I'm seeing the place where Figo, Quaresma, Ronaldo, Nani, they've come through the academy. I saw their names on the wall, and spit and sawdust type gym, nothing fancy, you know, weights like an old school boxing gym. And I watched all their methods, but he then introduced me to PSV, Ajax, then Barcelona, then Borussia Dortmund, the PSG, and jumped down the line, jumped ahead 4 or 5 years, 6 years. This became Next Gen Series. But at the time, I watched Valencia and their school model. I watched Willem Twee in Holland and their school model, how they secured the young players despite having Ajax and the bigger clubs on their doorstep. So I learned so much in that year. At the end of that, Ian, I felt far more equipped. I'm sure you would do if you went around, you know, various media as a young journalist. I was so better equipped, so better aware of the standards. So people say to you, oh, he's a world-class player. No, he's not. No, he's not. He's good. He's good. He's not. He's nowhere near world-class. And I knew, watching the Barcelona kids at La Masia, unbelievable place, La Masia, the most courteous people. They were fantastic for me, but learned so, so much on how they train the young players, the recruitment, how La Masia works. Ajax, the same at the time, were magnificent, Ian. And as I say, I could go back to Watford and I knew I was far better equipped and I could then really accelerate quickly. Eddie Boothroyd was a manager. Suddenly he's asked me to become, you know, quickly I was, he set up the school model, the Harefield School, the first of its type in the country, working with Harefield, some great staff, Pat Cottison, the staff there. And all the clubs came to look at Harefield, Ian, because here we had 55 boys combining sporting and academic achievement. And I felt in a good bit, I was academy director quickly. And I felt, you know, there was that acceleration to get into it. So it sort of justified what was a massive decision for me. And I've never wanted to paint a rosy picture in, because it sounds easy. Do a job, take a big pay cut, do really well. Everything's fine, no problem. It wasn't like that. You know, I remember Sean Dyche was my youth team coach at Watford. We worked close together, best mates. And I think we had a flat tire by the side of the M25, peeing down with rain. I'm looking there thinking, what are we doing here? What are we doing? So it's not all rosy. It's far from rosy, but I've always had a good work ethic and that sort of, like, I've jumped right ahead there, Ian, in the chat with you, but you can see how you have to have more education. That gave me the platform to really spring in and move quickly and accelerate quickly. And I found myself academy director and then in a good position.
So how did you get seduced by Brentford then? Because that's when I think people really started to notice the job that you were doing.
Yeah, what happened at Brentford, how can I put this? This is a bizarre one. The owners of Watford changed. Some Italian gentlemen came in and they basically said that the club was broke. It was completely bankrupt. And if the school model, now I've got 55 kids in this school, but imagine it's one of your boys in the school, and they said, you have to go and find funding. So I went back into the city and went to a big investment house and got the funding. And I took the head teacher, I took this another coach with me. It's all very official. And then suddenly Watford, there was a guy there who was very driven to basically take over the football of the club, the whole football side. And he accused me of acting against the best interest of the club. I ended up getting 12 months money and a great glowing reference. But that put me in a period of not working for like 3 or 4 weeks. But in the time, I'd introduced Matthew Benham, the Brentford owner, to come in and look. He was having problems trying to buy Brentford in. It was owned by a supporters group and he couldn't get all the shares and he wanted to buy a club. So I brought him in to meet AD and then I brought him in to meet Brendan Rodgers, who came in, Malcolm Mackay, he said to Sean. But then Matthew bought Brentford. So long story short, Matthew, I think, changed the manager, Andy Scott. And I get a phone call at 1 o'clock in the morning, 10 past one it was in the morning. And Matthew said, will I come in and coach the first team for the rest of the season? Nicky Forster was a player. He would be like a figurehead the fans knew because no one knew who I was. So would you come do the coaching? And that was the first time in, I was up all night on Google trying to look at the players to learn their names and put faces to names, etc. But then I spent the rest of January through to the end of the season coaching the team. They were 18th in League One when I took over. I think we finished 10th. So we had a solid start. And I really enjoyed it, really enjoyed it. And then I thought I would get the job. And he gave it to Uwe Rosler, very famous, you know, Manchester City, German international, and asked me to become technical director, which in hindsight was the best thing that ever happened. I did all the work with the agents. I was in charge of the first team, the academy, medical, sports science, analytics, you coach, you name it. I was in charge of the whole football department. It was brilliant. I loved it. It allowed you to set the environment in. It allowed you to set the whole ethos of the football club. And I really, at the time I was peed, I didn't get the manager's job, but I wanted it. But then so thankful to Matthew because he was a great guy to work for. I spoke to him every night, loved working with Uwe. I really, if you can imagine, Ian, I knew he was the coach and I knew that I didn't want him to be threatened by me. So there was a white picket fence around the pitch and I never went inside that. And Uwe used to say, come in. But I would say, no, that's your place, Ian. If it was you, Ian, I'd say, that's just your workplace. I'm not a threat. I'm not going to come in. And Uwe really respected that. And we got on great. You know, we would breakfast every morning, coffee. We would argue like cat and dog, but always in private and come out and go to dinner every week. And it was a really good relationship. And I learned so much. And I signed a lot of the players. So the likes of Tarkowski, the likes of Adam Forshaw, Leeds, the likes of Stuart Dallas, the likes of Alan Judge, the likes of Pritchard, all these various players, Johnny Douglas, all these type of players. I was signing them as a technical director, dealing with their agents, getting to know the players really well. So then when Uwe left to go to Wigan, and I became, and Matthew asked me to become manager, it was a natural transitioning. They knew me, they knew I'd, in a nice way. They knew that I could coach, they knew I could handle myself on the football field, so I'd done that. But they also knew how I acted. I'm a massive believer in respect him. I don't want to sound like a fuzzy old man, but I'm a massive believer in respect, you know, timekeeping, how you speak to people, etc. I've got no problems if you want to argue about a session, but do it in a respectful manner. And I've always maintained that from the city right the way through football. So the boys knew me, and that gave me a really good platform to start the managerial career at Brentford.
I'll just point out I was 20 minutes late for this interview, and I feel thoroughly ashamed now, Mark.
Horribly ashamed, but I won't mention it again.
2014, and you finished runners-up, promoted to the Championship, a club that kind of had struggled really since the 60s, Brentford. And at the end of 2015, it looked like the club wanted to go one way, you wanted to go the other, and Scotland beckoned. So how did Rangers court you as a club that size, coming for somebody who was still not a kind of very well-known commodity in Scotland?
Well, I've got to be careful I answer this in a nice way, because what I learned is football is all about fads. You know, you win. So we went, my first 19 games as manager of Brentford were unbeaten. I didn't realise at the time. We're just going on, one, you know, picking off the games, and you get promotions, you said, and you get to fifth in the playoffs, and your stock becomes incredibly high. But I was a little bit older than, say, the average manager, so I'm sitting there thinking, well, I'm still the same person I was 6 months ago. You're learning all the time, you know, but football is fads. So your stock is high, and then suddenly it's not. It's high, and suddenly it's not, et cetera. So when what happened, and all it was, sorry, answers this part of the question. Matthew wanted to bring certain players in. I just said, can we do it in the summer, not in the January window, because we were second to Bournemouth in a good position. And that was it. Matthew's the owner. He writes the checks. Huge respect for him. That will never change. But my stock was high. My stock was high because we got promoted. We had a really good run. We had young, talented. I mean, the likes of Tarkowski, the likes of Forshaw, Dallas, Judge, Hotter, Andre Gray, Dougie, you know, Harley Dean, Jake Bidwell, all David Buckling. These all went on to play Premier League football, and Tarkey and all these guys are still playing now. So my stock was high. And David Weir was my assistant, but dear friend, clever guy. Huge respect for David and Frank McParland, two of my best friends in life, let alone football. And David Weir just said to me, and I had a number of offers in. I met some big, big clubs and a number of offers. Very fortunate to do so, but my stock was high. So suddenly you're inundated. And then David said, speak to Rangers. They'd like to speak to you. And obviously David Weir being it, David really filled me in. We met in London, first of all, at a really, really good meeting and a good second meeting. And I get an offer now. Petlis and the Rangers fans know where I'm coming from. At the time, they're in the Championship, and I had these offers on the table from some big clubs, who are now Premier League big clubs. And I'm sitting there, and I think I've got to make this right call. I must get this right. And my son came in. I've told this story before, but dead true. And he said to me, there's no decision to be made, Dad. It's Rangers. So I said, yeah, Jack, I know, but I'm very lucky to have this, and I've got to get this one right. And he said to me, you put up YouTube, and it was Penny Arcade, Rangers versus Celtic, and it was 8 minutes long, and he just played this Penny Arcade, and that was it, Ian. The atmosphere before the Old Firm game, Celtic having the end, you know, the whole end, the atmosphere around it, and the team's going, Jack says, there's no way. And that's exactly how it went. I couldn't turn it down. And you asked about a side story. I'm sitting in Bowers, I'd love to see Graham. At the time, when it came out, I was told absolute confidence, not a soul could know about Rangers. So I was asked to do Norwich versus Middlesbrough Championship playoff final with Harry Redknapp. And I was sitting there and I was waiting while the game was going on. And Graham Souness came down and sat beside me. Obviously a privilege to sit with him. But I didn't know that he knew. So he starts talking about Rangers and I'm thinking absolute confidence. I knew about obviously his history with the club, But I'm thinking, they've told me specifically, don't say a word, don't go on the subject. So I'm sitting there thinking, how do I not? And Graham, to this day, must have thought I was ignorant not to really get into conversation. He was going to me, it's a great club, Rangers. It's a great club. I was going, yeah, absolutely. Good game, this, isn't it? And I was trying to get it off of the Rangers. He must have thought, what an ignorant ass. And it wasn't, but I was just in my ear. They're Graham having the fact, do not tell a soul because of various reasons. And they're sorting out, you know, ex-managers and stuff. So to this day, I'd love to see Graham just apologise. He said some nice things in the press, but he must have thought, what an ignorant ass to not really talk about because you're sitting with Graham Souness. But that was a situation. Anyway, I chose Rangers, and so glad I did, Ian, because, as I say, the best club in terms of just an absolute privilege to have been there, and still hurts what happened at the end of it. But, you know, David Weir, credit to him for preventing it. And some of my best friends now remain my friends from Glasgow, you know, and it was an absolute pleasure and privilege to be there.
What was your initial old fudge moment when you arrived at Rangers? Because Rangers are, I don't think you can comprehend Rangers unless you've lived in Glasgow for a while and Celtic as well. What was the first time when it hit you, like, oh my goodness, it's different at this club?
The first time probably was walking around from the initial bit of media I had to do to the press conference. Now, I can say this without, I won't mention the name, but you will know exactly who I mean. There was one media guy at the club that certainly was not working for the management, not working for me and Davey. And to this day, I detest the man with absolute passion. But he was in charge of the media. Now, I remember the first part of the question, Ian. I walked around the pitch to the dugouts, and you look around a magnificent stadium, you look up at the main stand, and you're looking around and you see the history, you smell the history of it. It was, and the grass was being cut, and this is a different, you know. I was very privileged to be at Brentford, Griffin Park, 10,000, you know, Ibrox, 50,000. And then I went into the press conference, and we went into the old manager's upstairs office, first of all, before going into the blue room. And that guy I told you about, he had me go out, he said to me it was a mistake, but we had us go out the wrong door, and we looked like idiots going out the wrong door. But you walked into, I think he said 70 or 80 press people, and you realise the size of the club. That's that moment when you go, this is huge. The blue room alone, the trophy room, etc. Looking around, the history of the club, the tradition of the club, the whole mentality of Rangers. That was it then. When you realise, you look around, David Weir, of course, on the Hall of Fame board, Ian, right? So he knew the club inside out. He'd cut in the UEFA Cup final. But David just sort of nudged me. And I really enjoyed it, the press conference. But that's when you get that massive feeling of pride, because it's just a huge club.
When you first arrived at Rangers, there was a big kind of turnover. A lot of players had left, kind of players that were big kind of names. And players came in. Were you behind a lot of the recruitment that first season, or was a lot of it already put in place?
No. We had 9 players. The chairman, Dave King, I think you might correct me, Ian, but 13 players were out of contract and never got renewed. And the first day of training, there was 9. And the 10th, I went down, and I think the academy were travelling, and there was a couple of boys up training, and I said, who's the rest runner? He said, well, Barry Mackay's over there. You take him, but you're probably going out somewhere. And we took Barry Mackay, and in a side story, I think 10 minutes in, I looked at David Weir and went, how good is this kid, Barry Mackay? And David Weir went, you took him magnificent to me. And that was it. I think at the end of that season, Barry was picked for the Scotland squad. But that was number 10. So we had 10 outfield players. We had a 5v5. Upbeat session, but we literally had no players at all, and that's why we had to go. And obviously Davey, myself, knew a lot of players. Frank McParland, one of the very best in the business in terms of recruiting. We only got the likes of Waghorn, James Tavernier, of course, and Wes Fodringham, and these type of players to come in. And we had to, you know, we were down at bare bones. You know, the job played by Kenny Miller and Lee Wallace was magnificent in terms of their enthusiasm, their impact on the squad, their mentoring. I can't be high enough about Kenny and Lee. But we really were down at bare bones here. And so it was a case that we had to move very quickly. It was done. You know, we were trying to get people, Danny Wilson in, come and get in. I remember I was arguing with the chairman over minimal, tiny amounts of money in comparison to Celtic. And the wage disparity I knew was so big. And everyone talked about Glasgow, of course, it's Rangers and Celtic, and at the time closing the gap. But the disparity was massive, Ian. So, you know, I was literally, I'd get another 50 quid on one player, 50 quid a week, I kid you not, for one player. That was a difference in what he and I thought we were prepared to offer. But that's where we were at the time. So we moved quickly on players, like so Rob Keenan coming in, did great job, loans like Don Ball and Gedeon Zalalem. But really, you know, Nicky Law, these guys coming in, Nicky Clark, they did a good job for us. You know, really, Dean Shields did a great job for us. And the likes of Andy Halliday, the whole team midfield, Andy Halliday bled blue, Rangers blue. You know, his family living 200 yards from Ibrox, but what a character, what a great professional. So we had a really small squad, Ian, but they were focused, they were driven, they were mentored by Lee and Kenny, and we could add one or two as and when they became available.
You think of some of the legendary signings that Rangers have made in the past, they've splashed out millions on players like Loudrop, Van Bronckhorst, Gascoigne, superstar names, tons of money. Has Rangers' best ever bit of transfer business been £200,000 for Tavernier? Tavernier, I could never pronounce his name right.
Yeah, it probably has. I don't mean, you know, delighted with that, but it probably has in terms of value. When you look at the amount, you go back to the Trevor Stevens and Terry Butchers and, as you say, all the names that have played for the club. But for Tav, in terms of what he's done and produced, and I'm trying to remember what the exact figure was. I don't know if it was 200 or 220. And then Waggy came in at the same time for 60-odd grand. But Waggy scored 37, 38 goals that first season, which people tend to forget because Tav scores so many goals. But Waggy did great as well. But no, it was good business. It was really good business. And we knew the leagues from the UK. We had to move there. And the likes of Holtie and Halliday, Andy Halliday, were just great bonuses for us. But yeah, that was a great bit of business. And the way he's performed for the club, Ian, and his record at the club, he deserves to have his name on a Hall of Fame board. That's for sure.
People might think, oh, well, it's just the Scottish Championship. Rangers were always going to coast it. But that season you had St Mirren and Hibs and Livingston and Falkirk all in that division. Rangers hadn't got out that division the season before. I think that was the season they lost the playoff game to Motherwell. But you didn't drop a point until the 1st of November. You broke Bill Struth's record of a debut manager with amount of games won in a row. It was a pretty sensational performance that season, to be brutally honest, for somebody who is a rookie to Scottish football, who's got no idea what Alloa Athletic away is really like.
It's good of you to say that. Thank you for that. Well, you're right, though. It is the education, and it's not the big games. It's not playing at Celtic Park or Hibs or Hart, those games. It's because you go into much smaller stadiums, or you're travelling up, you know, Ross County, or you're travelling up wherever it may be. And David Weir's obviously been there and done it. So, as you said, as a rookie coming into Scottish football, it's getting used to that, the mindset, because you can't help but think it's Rangers. So the first bit you forget is that it's the opposing team's cup final. Whenever Celtic or Rangers come into town, it becomes a huge game for the opposition. And you would go and watch, you know, I'd go and watch a team, or we'd do the analysis. Say you're preparing for Livingston. No disrespect to Livingston at all. I'm preparing for Livingston, say, and you're watching their previous three or four games, and they've had a shaky run, and they look dodgy at the back, and they look. And then when you play them, their players look inspired. And you're sitting there thinking, this is a different team. And then you have to quickly realise that every game you play, when you're Rangers or Celtic, becomes a cup final. And it sounds an old cliche, but that's the learning curve. And thankfully, we learned that really quickly. And you know that if Rangers drop any points, then, you know, there's front page news. And, you know, if you're drawing, David Weir said to me, if you're drawing 0-0 at home at Ibrox, you get booed off at halftime. They'll cheer you back on, but they'll boo you off. And it's all of these little messages and these lessons that you have to learn. So I loved that first season. I really enjoyed it. Obviously, the culmination in terms of Celtic game, etc. But I loved that first season because it showed a squad settling in. We knew we had to add quality. But the boys deserve so much credit, Ian, for what they achieved in terms of they won a training cup. Everyone will say it's only a training cup, but it's a trophy you have to win, right? You have to go there and you have to win it. They won the league by 11 or 13 points and they got to the cup final, and they deserve enormous credit for what they achieved in a short period of time.
Did your background with it change the way the Challenge Cup was perhaps viewed in Rangers? Because the goal is always going to be getting promoted. the Challenge Cup's never the highest thing on the list, but a trophy is a trophy, and some of those players might never get the chance to win another trophy in their life. That might be their only medal.
Absolutely right. And that was, yeah, I always remember that when Enfield played, we played games. I remember, Enfield played Barnsley away, Oakwell, when they were Barnsley, were Premier League or League One at the time, Division One team. And we drew at Oakwell, them back, and the game was played, not at our stadium, it was held like 6,000 to 7,000, but it was held at White Hart Lane. And I remember we were getting the coach down to this game at White Hart Lane, Tottenham High Road, and they were having the boys having a sweepstake in, like five are in on the crowd. And I think the highest estimate of a crowd was like 14,000. And you'll correct me, but I think it was a 38,000 sellout at White Hart Lane at the time, complete sellout. But Barnsley underestimated us, certainly up there. And I always took that into my Rangers side, saying that when you're playing a perceived smaller club, then they've got nothing to lose approach. They can just go and play, and Rangers are expected to win. And that's a heavy burden. So people talk about the heavy shirt of Rangers, a heavy shirt of Celtic. It's because of that expectation. Whenever they go out, the fans, how many are going to win by? Not are you going to win, but how many are you going to win by? And that's that expectation. So as you rightly say, playing Peterhead, in the final, you know, Tav's got a great goal, etc. But it was a trophy. I think the Rangers fans filled 95% of the stadium. It was a chance for them to celebrate. It's been a long time in the wilderness coming back, as you say, missed promotion the season before. And it was a chance to have a good day out. So absolutely, why would you not maximise that, Ian?
Well, I mean, that was a success that you had. And I'm sorry to kind of break your heart all over again, but the cup final was a tough loss for a manager to be winning and then to lose two late goals. One of the consolations is you were playing against John McGinn, who's like one of the greatest Scottish players in the last 20 years. I don't know if that's any consolation whatsoever, but...
Not really.
Do you take that game as a learning point going forward as a manager to say, right, there's something I can take from that. I didn't set us up in the right way at the last part of the game to maintain the victory.
You always learn, Ian. And I was accused of being very clear. Firstly, Hibs won the game, right? So congratulations to the winners. They won the game. But I kid you not, we had people like, I forget some of the players now, Ryan Hardy and these boys, Tommy, had gone out on loan and we couldn't play them. You couldn't make them in the matchday squad. And if you look at the squad for the cup final, I named 14 players. I got a question. Why did you only... We had no one else. We literally had no one else. What would I have done better? It was 3 weeks from our last game to the cup final. All the teams were breaking up. I was trying to find games to play. And also, what you're doing. I'm not digressing. It's all relevant to the subject. What you're doing 3 weeks? Do you give the boys a week off and then do a mini pre-season and get back? Do you keep them ticking over? Sports science, I spoke to people at the FA, SFA. I spoke to big clubs down south and always got different answers. Some would say give them 10 days off, refresh them, give them back, get them going on the beach. But then you think, well, you've got a cup final to play. So in the end, the only game I could find to play was a good friend of mine, John McDermott, who's now the tech director of the FA, was a Canada director at Spurs. And he had a team in still. And we flew the boys down and we played the Spurs B team, basically, on a beautiful pitch in the Spurs training centre. That's the only game we could find in. And literally, had so many injuries. I'm looking, I said, they players. And when we went, When Andy Halliday scored the goal, which I thought was going to be the winner, it was a sense of like, oh, just get through this. I wasn't enjoying it because it was a hot day, if you remember. It was a slog. We just didn't have the strength in depth. And you could see it was just one of those games to, of course, you want to win the trophy for the fans. It's the Scottish Cup final. Of course, you want to win it. But it's one of those to get through because you knew we were depleted and everything else. And then what happened late on with the set pieces was heartbreaking, soul destroying. But the learning part was how you deal with that 3 weeks, because you want to be in more trophies, you want to be in more finals. But that was a big learning curve. And many, many sports scientists have come up to me since then and asking what we did, what we've done better, what hurt us, because it was almost the unknown in, what did you do in 3 weeks? And it's that's the bit I should have allocated the time far better than we probably did.
Well, Rangers won the championship on the 5th of April, guaranteed to be in the Premier League the next season. How long did it take for somebody to take away from the joy of winning and put the pressure on of this is what you need to do next season, because you'd bump into a punter in the street and the second part of your sentence would be pressure about what you have to do against Celtic.
Yeah, you know what the time was? The semi-final was that time. Because, of course, quite rightly, after what the board of directors had been through, you know, what the supporters had been through, that day was fantastic for them. That day, you know, when Tom Roberts put that ball over the bar and Wes ran round and everyone, that the Davey Weir, see, Davey Weir, Jim Stewart, top man, Jim Stewart, one of the very best, Rangers through and through. But to see what it meant to these people and the fans, that was great. But afterwards, Ian, I kid you not, I'm not trying to sound like some, you know, calm forward thinking, but everything said now you've put the warning shot across Celtic, they won't be looking forward to your return to the Premier League. And I'm looking at our midfield that day, and I remember we had Don Ball and Andy L. Halliday and Jason Holt. And Don was on peanuts from Spurs on the young professional loan. I looked at it and I went, the combined salary of my three midfielders doesn't add up to one third of Scott Brown. That's it. My midfield three doesn't add up to a third of one of their players. And that was it. They were packed internationals. And you know, and I know, and the Rangers fans won't mind me saying this, 9 times out of 10, they're going to win that game. Roberts missed from the 5 yards out inexplicably. Great save from Wes from the free kick, etc. Yes, we had our chances, of course. And we deserved to win and played outstandingly well. But 9 times out of 10, a team packed of internationals like that will win that game. That was our day. Fantastic. But I knew then, and David Weir and I spoke, and Frank, of course, spoke, that the expectation, Ian, suddenly went through the roof. We got everyone in the club, the directors talking about how we're going to batter Celtic. And that, from that moment on, that's when I knew we had a real problem the following season.
Well, I mean, the following season, it was kind of very dramatic from your kind of standpoint, but it's always dramatic at Rangers or Celtic, let's be honest. Anytime you bump into a Rangers fan or somebody that knows Scottish football, they're going to ask you two questions. And the first question, and it's not a very exciting answer, and I think I know the truth behind it, but what happened with Joey Barton?
Yeah, you want to answer that one first? Well, obviously, the difficulty with the situation with Joey was that it went legal. And as such, Ian, you know yourself, anything goes legal, you're duty-bound to say nothing. So you've got some papers, you've got some very good papers in Scotland, you've got some very dubious papers in Scotland, you've got some sensationalist reporters, you've got some outstanding reporters. Let's just say the sensationalist writers were all over that like a rush. You know, I remember another day goes by with nothing from Rangers manager Warburton. Why won't he comment? Clearly he's in the wrong. I couldn't comment, it was a legal case. So you used to sit there with the frustration. Joey, I'm not going to talk about an individual. Joey's doing what he's doing now. And at the time, Joey, in my opinion, as manager of the football club, in David Weir's opinion, in everyone's opinion, apart from Joey's, was bang out of order in how he behaved, how he conducted, how he respected the squad or disrespected the squad. And I made a call. I made the right call. It was the only thing I could do. And that's it. I'm not going to say anything. Joey had his reasons. Joey was a very, very talented footballer. We know that. Championship team of the year before for Burnley. We had an outstanding season. But for whatever reason, you know, maybe thinking that it would be easy to come out of Scottish football, I don't know. But it didn't work out. It didn't work out. So I couldn't say anything. I was duty bound. The press bullied me because of that. But I had to by legal counsel. But I know, and everyone would tell you if I really could tell you the story, then you know I did the right thing.
Well, it didn't really affect the club too much because results were actually okay until you got to December time when you had to meet Hearts and Celtic, two incredibly tough ties and a couple of losses from those games. But the second question that any Rangers fan is going to ask is what actually happened when you departed Rangers, because it seemed like there was different narratives coming from different sides and it seemed like your side made sense and the other stuff didn't.
Ian, there's only one story and I've got no shame. I love Rangers to bits. I haven't been back to Ibrox. I'd love to go back. So I'm never going to say any disrespect to the club. Love the club to bits and to boards. So nothing I say will ever be disrespectful to the club. But at an earlier board meeting, I think in August, I was told that the targets would be that in year three, we had to make European football. It was non-negotiable. When I joined the club, that term non-negotiable being used, the promotion to the Premier League was non-negotiable. Fine. And I thought to myself, if we can't get out of Championship as Rangers, then okay, I deserve to get sacked. No problem. I had no issue taking it under those conditions. So here we are in this board meeting and sentiment is really high. We've signed Joey. We got Nico Crenshaw, though Nico was well overweight, but we knew the effect it had on the squad, the likes of Clint Hill coming in, all three transfers, by the way, no money, but all three, and on minimal, very, very low wages, but good influence, good professionals. And they said to me, in year three, we have to have European football. Okay, fine. And I said, David and Frank, I said again, if we can't get European football next year, then we deserve to lose our jobs. So that was it. For year two, it was develop the squad, keep developing the playing style, which I think is fair to say, and we got a lot of praise the way we played football and we were attack-minded. We had those two results, as you say. And suddenly, we had a board meeting and it became, the tone changed. It was manufactured, it was set up, it was completely choreographed, the questions came bang, 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 bang in an order. And it was literally, I'm thinking, the year, we were second in the table. We were second at the time in the table. And year three, we've got to make Europe. So here we are in year two and we're second. But the problem was Celtic had the best year in their history. So this was the issue, Ian. If Celtic had been 8 or 9 points ahead, no problem. Celtic were 18 points ahead, 15 or 18 points ahead. And that now, to any Rangers fan, and the board, of course, are diehard Rangers fans, the fact is it was the gap between us that was causing the big issue. But again, there's Dembele on, you know, it's not fanciful numbers, but when they got players on 20, 25, 30, 35,000 pound a week, and we've got players on 2, 3, 5, I remember, I digress, a journalist saying to me, how could I justify paying Nico Crenshaw 25 grand a week? Ian, Nico and I laughed our socks off. Nico was on a fraction. He was on a fraction of the 25 grand a week. Nowhere near a quarter of that. But that was a journalist and the fans immediately thought, you know, they read the record of what it was and he's on 25 a week. Absolute nonsense. But I knew that we could get nowhere near Celtic, but we were still second. They had their stellar season and it turned out to be the best year in Celtic's history. Again, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's still the best year they've ever had. So that was it, and the tone changed. And then we were preparing for a cup game. And again, I apologize that you've asked me the question, so I'll answer it, Ian. It was a Friday night. I was on my flat in the West End, and it was 5 to 9. And my phone went with an email saying, and it came from Stuart Robertson, saying, Mark, please check your email. Now, I hadn't been able to get hold of Stuart. I got on great with Stuart. But I hadn't been able to get hold of him on the phone or email for like 7 or 10 days, which is really strange. So I said, check me around. Friday night, I was preparing for the game and I'm watching Sky Sports. And on the ticker tape, it came up and suddenly my phone starts jumping. Mark Warburton resigns from his role as manager of Rangers. And Ian, I kid you not, imagine you're lying back on the sofa on a Friday night on your own in the flat and you see that come across the yellow ticker tape. On my life. I'll take it to anyone who says otherwise. And I'm thinking, what? My phone's now jumping. So I phoned David Weir. I said, David, I think I've just been sacked. He said, so have I. I said, why? And as I looked over at the screen, it said, David Weir also leaves his role and resigns his position from Rangers Football Club. And David and I are going, what is going on here? Of course, I client phone Stuart. The email says, we accept your resignation. There is no resignation. I've never resigned. I'm preparing for the game tomorrow. So this was exactly how it happened, Ian. So we're sitting there, Davey and I are going, well, Davey lives a mile away. Frank McPyle lived 3/4 mile away down Byers Road. I'm by the Botanical Gardens. I'm going, what's going on here? So I walk around and go, what the? Of course, my phone is now going nuts. I've got my wife saying, why didn't you tell me you'd resigned? I didn't know. So you can, all this is going on and it sounds like a comedy sketch. I promise you, Ian, it's exactly how it went. So I'm trying to get hold of anyone at the club, not a chance. The only people who are still there now, the security guys, Robin and David, outstanding people. There were so many outstanding people at the club. They were outstanding. And I'm like, what do I do here? I've no idea what goes on. I haven't resigned. Of course, I found the LMA lawyer. Jump forward, everyone says, why didn't you sue the club? If we do that, when you get bogged down, I won't be working, so I'll be involved in a legal case. Scottish law and English law allows that Scottish lawyers can come into English courts, but English lawyers can't go to Scottish courts, so I'd have to get Scottish. All of this. The sheriff, Lindsay, who's now sadly recently passed, but a great friend and really helpful to me, David Weir's big friend, he was sort of helping, saying to us, this is nonsensical, but you can't bog yourself down in a legal case. So everyone, the fact I didn't sue them, everyone thought immediately that I had resigned, I was guilty. Not a chance, Ian, not a chance. And I remember death threats. I remember I traveled home to my wife, bearing in mind I have to go back up again and tidy the apartment and pick up stuff for the training ground. And I couldn't speak to my wife for the 6.5-7 hours to get home in the car because I was getting the person I told you about, I know, had released my number. So I was getting battered with calls, battered, either Rangers or Celtic, you know, you can imagine the type of calls you get. But my phone immediately filled up. I learned that you have 249 text messages. Because he got the 249, my box was filled, and you go delete everything, and it was literally going fill again. That's what it was. It was the most bizarre period of my life, and I drove all the way to London. Now I stop at the Westbourne Shops or West something Shops, Westmoreland Shops, on the M6, and I had no change. I needed a phone box for years, and I had to borrow 20p or something. I'll get some change to phone the wife and say I can't get on my phone. I can't get on because it's just literally filling up with thousands of calls. So that was it, Ian. We went back, and what made it worse was about 3 weeks later, I get a phone call from the new owners of Nottingham Forest, Mr. Maranakis, said, would I meet with Mr. Maranakis? He'd like to offer me the job or speak to me. It's Nottingham Forest, European champions. I've just left Rangers. I'm not ready to be out of work and rest. I'm not ready to, you know, have a prolonged period of 6 months on the sidelines. So who wouldn't speak to Nottingham Forest? Of course, they put two and two together, made five, and said, well, that's why I left Rangers. Ian, we had no idea. It was a shocking way to treat us. It was totally wrong. It was totally inappropriate. We were second in the table. And to this day, you can probably hear my voice, how much that has. I'd rather have been fifth, sixth, getting battered, being sacked, no problem, fully justified. To act in that way, and I've often said on radio, and said, if they could show me one phone call, if they could show me one email, obviously show me a letter, I'd love to see the letter. I've never, ever resigned or given any inclination to that respect. And therefore, when this happened, you can imagine how surreal it felt, because it's Rangers. Rangers are all about acting with dignity and respect and professionalism, and this was the first time, Ian, that I saw this and went, no, this is wrong. This is so, so wrong. And I wanted, and of course, the fans who believed, as you said, there's two sides to a story. So the fans who believed the other side, I can imagine their disgust at me, their hatred, and why would he walk out on Rangers? And who would walk out on Rangers, Ian? In their right mind, who would walk out on Rangers? I say to everyone, down south, there's an ignorance about how big those two clubs are. I always say, until you go there, no one in their right mind. You'd walk up the M6 all the way to get to Rangers to be a named manager of that club.
Yeah.
So it still galls me, as you can say, I'm getting angry even speaking to you, because you would never do that. And I would never act like it to any club. So that particular individual dealt so badly, so inappropriately with that. But I think the good friends, I've got so many good friends up there, and they know what happened. And hopefully the genuine fans know what happened. I've got to be honest, every time I met Rangers fans, even I went to see Bruce Springsteen last Saturday at Wembley, and there was a load of Rangers fans, and they were fantastic. They were fantastic, Ian. So I've had some really nice compliments from Rangers fans, really nice statements from them, but that still irks more than you can possibly imagine.
Well, I personally, Mark, was delighted that you had, in inverted commas, left Rangers, because I was an Aberdeen fan and I thought you were the best manager they'd had in ages. So by you leaving, it made Aberdeen were a better team, so I was over the moon, but I was quite confused.
Yeah. Oh, well-received comments, Ian, because you've got to go and impress a football public in Scotland that don't know who you are, as you rightly said when you first got up there. You've just come from a small club down south. So who is this guy coming up? So you've got to try and establish a reputation and build a solid reputation. So it's always well-received when you hear comments like that. But as I say, I'll go to my deathbed being irritated by the fact that they didn't behave in the manner that a club of that stature has always before and has since hopefully behaved in the right way.
Was it tough when you went to Forest? Because there's still a lot of fans are still essentially in love with Brian Clough, and what he did was a very kind of difficult place to be effectively at that time.
It was a really difficult place to be because I'm in enormous respect for Mr. Marinakis. And what he's doing now with the club is fantastic. And obviously Olympiacos, et cetera. So he's done fantastic things for Nottingham Forest, committing money and generally backing the club, which is great to see. When I first went in there, it was the end of the Fawaz era, who I never met. I never met Mr. Fawaz. But there was a lot of uncertainty in the club. There was, you know, people had been there too long in the football department and there was massive change. And when I first went in there, Ian, I think we had 34, 35 players. We had 11 international players on loan, some didn't speak English, training with the under-23s on serious money, on money which would dwarf anyone in the Rangers team. That's what they were on. We had Ross McCormack on loan from Aston Villa, who Ross never played, had some issues and never played. And it was just a really unsettling period. And they were in the bottom three, and the only goal was to avoid relegation. And on the last game of the season, Tony Mowbray was at Blackburn. They had to better our result by 2 goals. Otherwise, they went down. And Brett Blackburn were playing Brentford, my old team. And we were playing Ipswich at Forest. And Brentford were 2-0 down at Blackburn in 20 minutes. So after 20 minutes, we're down. We're down at Forest. And you think, wow. And we had a great second half. We came back. We won the game. It was great. And we stayed up, which was the goal. But the problem is you've got a really expectant fan base. A fan base, as you rightly said. When I was there, the media team, and on my second day, were talking to me, and they're all gone now, unfortunately. They were good people, but they all spoke to me about planning for the 40th anniversary of the European Cup triumph. I'm going, what do you mean, 40th anniversary? 78, 79, et cetera, 80. We're going to plan for the 40th anniversary. And that was all the talk. I said, but that's 40 years ago. And I was at pains to say, fantastic. What, to win the European Cup twice, on the fourth, Ian, to this day, what an unbelievable achievement. You couldn't write it, you couldn't write the script. But I said, here we are now. We just avoided relegation. Now we've got to build here. And it was a really tough time. And the fan base didn't know what my mandate really was. And I never felt that I got the connection with the fan base. I should have done, because the fans are fantastic. But it was just a really strange time. Really strange time. And again, you learn from football, and the KPIs were reduce the age of the squad, which is 29, reduce the size of the squad, which is 34, and get mid-table. And I think I'd be right in saying the average age was just under 23. The squad size was 24, and we were 13th, bang on mid-table, and you get sacked. You go, well, that's what other industry, come for banking industry in. You know yourself, you've been a stockbroker, you where KPIs are, you know, bang, hit your KPIs, everything's good. Football doesn't work like that. So it's a really steep learning curve, football. There's Rangers acting as they acted. You've now hit your KPIs, you've still got sacked, and you realise that's just how the game is. There's, you know, you're only ever 3 games away from the sack, and supporters laugh when I hear people say that. It is so very, very true.
Did you have more fun going back to QPR as a Londoner going back home?
Interesting. Few messages, because obviously QPR and Brentford, there's no shortage of hatred between those two clubs. But yeah, it was, I'd go to the MLS. I did the last two for a couple of jobs in the MLS. I've always been intrigued by America and the market growing over there. And then QPR came in and they'd finished 19th, I think, under Steve McLaren. And it was about setting the boat. And yeah, I liked it. And go back to the Jock Wallace story, or along those lines, Ian. When I was at school, my best mate was a guy called Neil McClintock. And Neil's dad was Frank McClintock. So if you remember Frank, Frank was the captain of Arsenal, Scottish, you know, international, double winning captain of Arsenal, of that great team with Bertie Mee and whatever else. And Frank was playing for QPR. And they were, he was in that team that finished second in the old league Division One to Liverpool. And I could reel off, you know, Gillard, Clement, Phil Parks, Mancini, you know, Don Masson, what do you call it, Jerry Francis, Dave Webb, you know, Don Givens and Stanley Bowles. You could reel a team off. And I went to see every home game. Frank took me to see every home game of QPR in 1976, 77, whatever it was. And they finished second, their highest ever league position. So I had this affinity with the club anyway. And then here I am, and I'm managing the club at Loftus Road. So again, really enjoyed that, really enjoyed it. And David Weir had gotten to Brighton. So it was John Eustace, who had been at Watford as a candidate director, John had been the first team player. Different staff, Neil Banfield from Arsenal. Different staff, different people, but I really enjoyed it. It's a great club. Great club. Ian, you've been at many clubs like QPR where the fan base is loyal. The atmosphere of home games can be electric. It's a tight game, and especially the night games under lights. It was fantastic. So I really enjoyed it. We had three good years there. But again, you know, expectation-wise, we were top six all season. Had a horrific injury list, and every manager's got no excuse. So I'm very aware of that. But anyone would say, we were down to goalkeeper number six. I had Kieran West come out of retirement. David Marshall, you know David Marshall.
Goalkeeper number six. Goalkeeper number six is me, is it not?
I'll tell you what. Enough. Chenny Dieng fractured his hand. Chenny's out. David Marshall came down, was brilliant. I can't believe, what a character David is. Fantastic pro. He'd never pulled a hamstring in his life. He was at Forest, hamstring goes. Then the third choice, Joe, had a similar place on a broken hand. The fourth choice then rolled his ankle and did all his ligaments. I'm thinking, we're down to goalkeeper number five here. We're going to go get a fifth one come in, and something happened with his contract, he's ineligible, and we literally had no goalkeepers at the club. And Kieran Westwood had left Sheffield Wednesday and was looking for a club and hadn't trained. And Kieran came in as an emergency goalkeeper, and said he came back for the last two games, I think it was. But we had a horrendous injury, finished 10th, but your contract's not renewed. And you go, well, you were 18th, the budget's not really been increased. We've had three solid years here. Lots of young players coming through. We've sold lots of Abire Eze and worked with Eze, and who's a top, top player in the Vietnam person. Ilias Chair, Chrissy Willock, all these people we bought who are doing really well. But it's not enough. It's not enough. And they haven't been there since. So, you know, it was nice feedback from Rangers fans. They were fantastic to me. Still are every day. I'm, you know, going through Heathrow, all Rangers fans and QPR fans, you get fantastic comments. But you realise football's a different industry, and you just got to take it and you got to swallow it. And there's going to be stuff which makes you just aghast. But that's football. And as long as you realise that, then you'll be fine.
See, from the previous conversation, I would say that you should have a T-shirt made that said, I signed James... When you're at QPR, you should have a T-shirt that said, I signed Lyndon Dykes, because Lyndon, to spot Lyndon Dykes at Livy with your time at Rangers, to realise that he would work, and he's like a mainstay for Scotland. Scotland arguably did badly at the Euros because Dykes wasn't there.
Yeah, listen, it was Agent Barry. I had a knee replacement. You can go back to what you said about the two really bad cruciates. And obviously over time, you know, osteoarthritis sets in your knee and all this stuff. So I had to have a knee replacement. And I literally had it, and I came out of hospital, and I remember sitting there, and I've got the game ready on my leg, the ice on my leg, and spoke to Barry, take a look at this centre forward, and I'm watching it on Y-Scout, and I'm looking at Lyndon, I'm going, I like this. He's physical, he's fearless, he runs, he closes down. Technically, clearly he was lacking certain areas, but he's a real athlete. And obviously you find out the Aussie side of his background, and was the fearless sporting nature of it. And we really liked him. And we moved for Lyndon. And it was good for us because he gave us a different type of player. We had Naki Wells, in, you may or may not know, still at Bristol City, a very talented player. But there's a technician, a very seasoned experience. And then you had the rawness of Lyndon. And Lyndon came in with Ilias Chair, Chrissy Willock, obviously Eberechi Eze, who he'll be the next £100 million player. What a superb talent he is. But we had some real quality. And then the likes of Lee Wallace at left back, coming in, you know, his experience was invaluable. So, yeah, it was good. But Lyndon came in, did a good job for us. And he's not the most consistent goal scorer at domestic level, but internationally, he's been a revelation. And I know Lindon will just love putting the jersey on. Lindon will be so proud and excited putting the jersey on. Ian, he's done a great job for you.
You're kind of out of management just now, Mark, but you clearly want to get back into it. Are you kind of open to near enough effort, anything?
I say this in a very, I hope it comes across in the right manner, Ian. You can't, you know, I've been very lucky to manage clubs like Rangers, like Brentford, like QPR. I went to West Ham with David Moyes. We won the Europa Conference and loved that. And to be at, you know, the clubs I've been at, Forest, etc., QPR, and be very, very lucky. But I've earned that. I don't mean to say that in an arrogant way, but I've worked my socks off to get to that point. And, you know, I was doing my A licence and up to the early hours of the morning, gap at 4:30. I remember a couple of nights having a black coffee, a cold shower, and that was it. There was no sleep, straight to work, banging out 15 hours, getting home, doing my logbook to get my work done. So I've worked hard to get that and had some, my CV is strong. I'm very lucky, but I've worked hard to get a good CV. So it's not just any club phones up and you just take it. I think I deserve more than that. But I've got to also face the fact that the trend down here, Ian, is to go for younger managers. I think technical directors are coming in who are younger. They're hiring younger managers. And you can't fight that trend. And I spoke to a number of very seasoned, very experienced, high-quality managers recently up at St. George's Park. And they're all equally frustrated. But you know yourself, in the media world, in the banking world, in the building world, there's trends, there's fads and trends. And sometimes you have to go with a trend or you try and fight the trend, you end up losing. So I definitely want to work. I'm not one that, you know, I've never been as fit, but I spend every morning on the Peloton bike here and walking. I've got the fittest dog in Hertfordshire next to me here because I walk him every day. But I'm not a good person when it comes to I enjoy working. I'm not ready yet for the retirement pastures, that's for sure. So it's about hoping that someone recognises your CV. It's about hoping that someone recognises what you do. As I said, I've got an offer stateside, which I'm looking at, and that's a fantastic opportunity. So maybe that's that. But there is a little bit inside of you that says, hang on a sec, you know, I've got win percentage of this and cup finals and promotions and surely you deserve an opportunity. But there'll be a lot of young coaches who likewise deserve opportunity. And so, yeah, I'll keep my eyes and ears open and hope very much that the right door does indeed present itself and I can walk through it.
All right. Well, let's have some fun and let's finish off some really quick questions. Who's the best opposing manager you've ever faced?
Best opposing manager. The obvious one to say is Brendan in terms of Celtic when they had their best ever season. That would be the respectful thing to say. I enjoyed very much Conte, Antonio Conte. We played Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. I very much enjoyed talking to him before the game for 40-odd minutes and how he thinks about the game, his passion. So I very much enjoyed that side of it. I've been very lucky to play against some big, very experienced managers. But I would say in terms of looking at someone with a little bit something different, I say Conte.
What's the best goal your team's ever scored?
Oh, the best goal. I would say QPR versus Stoke City opening game when Eze finished it off. We played from the back, from Joe Lumley in goal. We popped it through the fullback, through Jeff Cameron in midfield, into Eze, and I think it's one of the best team goals that I've seen. We scored a number of good goals, of course, but if I had to just go with one, I remember the commentator come up to me after the game and how excited he got. But that's probably one of the best goals. If you watch that goal, QPR away at Stoke City, Eze's goal, second goal, it was a magnificent goal by the team.
What's your favourite stadium you've ever managed at?
Ibox.
Okay. This is like asking to choose between your children. What's the best signing you've ever made?
Oh, God, how can you ask me that one? The best sign I've ever made. Listen, there's obvious ones, right? You look at Tev, you look at Lee, you look at the various Tchaikovskys and Andre Greys and all of these. I guess the best signing in terms of value and where it went to Stuart Dallas. I went to Northern Ireland on a shockingly bad night weather-wise and watched Stuart. And we ended up paying £5,000 for Stuart Dallas, who, you know, tragically just had to curtail his career end of last season after that horrible broken leg, 3 months, et cetera. But what a talent. what a boy, what a player. And to see him do so well in Premier League and being like, you know, the ever-present in Leeds United under Bielsa and the way he played for us. He could play, Ian, any position. You say to Stu, you're playing left back. All right, no problem, Gaff. You're playing right, wide right. No problem, Gaff. Centre forward today, Stu. No problem, Gaff. He would just do anything. And you look at where he played for Leeds, Ian, it would support that. But in terms of his career, in terms of what he gave, in terms of £5,000, it's the best £5,000 Matthew Bennett would ever spend in his life.
Have you ever had a transfer regret, as in, I can't believe I didn't sign that player when I had the chance?
Yes. Here's a true story. I got a phone call. I hope I'm not mind saying this. On the day I signed a certain Mr. B at Rangers, who you've talked about earlier in this chat, I got a phone call that afternoon from Brian at Man City to say, would I be interested in taking Aaron Moy on loan? And it was literally 2 hours after the other deal had been done. And I'd admired him and enormous respect and trust in Brian Marwood and his judgment of players. And literally, I remember putting the phone down. I knew I had no money to go and ask for it. I would have taken the both in a heartbeat. But we missed out on Aaron Moy. And I'm thinking Aaron Moy at Rangers in that second year, how good he would have been for us, what he went on to do in the Premier League, etc. But that was the one that got away for sure.
And finally, what's the best crowd chant you've ever heard, as in either emotionally getting to you or just funny?
The funny one's got to be Warburton is magic. He wears his magic hat. Because I never forget when we played Hibs that first game, and there's some bloke with a bread bin stuck on a traffic cone on his head, Ian. And I remember Davey and Frank and I laughing in the back of the bus. So in terms of humour and that one, and they used to sing that, even the Rangers at the Springsteen concert sang that. In terms of the chants, I just loved. I get very, I would say emotional is probably too strong a word, but when you hear some of the great songs, but I've been privileged to be at, you know, certain Anfield when they sing it, when they play Barcelona, and you've been in some big stadiums. For me, when the build up to an Old Firm game for Rangers, there's not many that can beat that. But I've been very privileged to be around the world in some great derbies, Boca Juniors and River Plate and these type of things. And some of the songs are absolutely magnificent. And as a Spurs fan, of course, it's seeing. I love the football fans because I love the passion of the game. I love the fans and the emotion that evokes in so many people. So I can't give you a favourite one. But as I say, Rangers for me will always live long in the heart for all the right reasons.
Well, that brings us to the end of another fantastic episode of the CSI Football Podcast. Join us next week for another forensic journey into the annals of Scottish football. It just leaves me to say thank you very much, Mark, for a fantastic insight into your life in football, and all the best in the future.
Yeah, really enjoyed speaking to you. Thanks very much indeed.